DNA testing gives investigators a space-age tool to tackle crimes, but for a real cold case, try solving the death of the World War I flying ace, the Red Baron, back in 1918, which has long puzzled history buffs. A new report in the Journal of Human Factors and Aerospace Safety argues that the fatal shot may have been fired many weeks before he took his final flight into enemy airspace. One of the authors of that article, neuropsychologist Thomas Hyatt, joins us now from the Veterans Administration Medical Center in Cincinnati. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Okay, let's start with that fateful bullet, and this is, some 9 months before he was actually...
Some 9 months before, the Red Baron Manfred von Richthofen found himself flying head-on towards a British observation plane. And he could tell that the pilot was shooting at him, but he wrote later in his journal that he wasn't too worried because there was such a distance between the two aircraft. And he had learned in combat that you needed to get fairly close, let's say 50 yards, before you opened fire, because these airplanes are relatively unstable gun platform. But at any rate, it must have been a lucky shot on the part of one Lieutenant Woodbridge, who was the observer in that airplane, who was firing the Lewis machine gun. Anyway, a bullet struck the Baron's skull, plowing about a 10-centimeter, which would be about 4-inch furrow into the skull. So it was a pretty serious hit, causing the Baron to temporarily, as he wrote later, he lost the use of his arms and his legs. He went temporarily blind. He lost control of the airplane. And luckily for him, he regained some of his faculties and pulled out of what could have been a fatal dive, crash-landed his airplane, crawled out, fell onto a bed of thorns, and lay there until he was rescued.
Mm-hmm. And again, this is 9 months before he was actually killed. What's your theory about what this head wound did to him?
Well, having worked with patients with head injuries, you know that there's a certain sort of a pattern or sequelae of events. In this case, it was not a penetrating head wound, so we wouldn't necessarily see so many focal signs, but it was an indirect wound, a very severe concussion at the very least. And in fact, we looked at a translation of the original medical records, and his doctors at the time speculated that he probably suffered a brain hemorrhage in addition to the concussion.
Many people after this injury reported that he was acting differently.
Well, there was a change. First of all, his mother noticed when he came home to visit her. She said her son had changed. She wrote here, "He does not look good and he is irritable." And she felt that he was altered. She said there was something painful around his eyes and temple. And she feared for him and told him that he should stop flying.
Might that behavior not be attributed to the stress of combat flying?
Well, I think this is post-concussion syndrome is what it is. And by the way, persons that have this disorder are much more vulnerable to stress, for example, the stresses of combat. Which is why if we were evaluating him in the Air Force, we would have, grounded him. Because when you're flying in combat, that's a fairly austere environment and a very critical environment. And if you are compromised, which I believe the Red Baron was, and I believe that was what led to his death. His judgment was compromised. He was more vulnerable to stress, more vulnerable to fatigue. And that's what did him in the end. He made a fatal error in the end.
Well, the error was, he violated a rule that he had laid out for the rest of the squadron that he was in command of, that you never pursue an enemy plane over enemy lines alone.
Well, yeah, he said, do not get involved in a long, unproductive pursuit, and worse to that effect. And yet, he did exactly that. And by the way, there's been some controversy whether or not he knew he was over enemy territory. I was just, looking through my notes. And because the wind had shifted, it was blowing all the airplanes that day towards the west, which would be the Allied lines. But he was blowing them right towards an Australian anti-aircraft battery. And there were puffs of smoke, appearing in the air, shrapnel, from flak. So everyone knew that they were getting close to enemy territory.
Mm-hmm.
But the Red Baron nonetheless chose to pursue a plane that had become already disarmed and was sort of a useless target in a way, except that the Baron was a hunter and a collector of trophies, and he had already had 80 kills to his guy looked like an easy kill. He abandoned the fight and went after this guy. Because this was a rather inexperienced pilot, he was a Canadian by the name of May. This was his first combat flight. May had got his guns jammed, so May was diving to get the heck out of there and was flying low and hoping to get back to the Allied lines. And here comes Baron von Richthofen after him. And because May was an amateur, May said he was flying very erratically, and he was kicking his rudder pedals and doing everything he could because he was scared out of his wits. And the Baron's, in the meantime, following him, firing his machine gun, but because May is flying erratically, he's not hitting him. And this pursuit just kept on and on until the Baron found himself down to treetop level over an Australian battery, and everybody on the ground started shooting. And eventually, somebody got him.
There's long been controversy, as well you know, whether it was the pilot who got him or whether it was that Australian anti-aircraft battery.
Well, there was a NOVA special about 6 months ago. In fact, that's what got me started on this paper. And I think they demonstrated fairly clearly that that the Baron was hit from ground fire. The body was recovered by the Australians, and physicians gave him a physical exam, not an autopsy, but certainly a physical examination of the body, and recorded in their journals at the time the entry and exit wounds. And by examining those, it became clear that somebody from the ground got him. The curious thing is, both the machine guns and the rifles fired .303 ammunition, so couldn't quite tell, was it one of the machine gunners in the anti-aircraft battery? Was it an infantryman firing his rifle up at him? Don't know.
We're talking with Thomas Hyatt, a neuropsychologist with the Veterans Administration, about the death of Manfred von Richthofen, the Red Baron. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. After Manfred von Richthofen's death, did anyone do an autopsy that would have disclosed the extent of that earlier head injury, the bullet that did kill him, that .303 went through his chest, as I understand?
Yeah. No, but as I say, at the time of the initial wounding, he did have an examination at a hospital. Wherein they described the nature of his wound, the groove in the skull. And by the way, his wound never healed. And the German physicians at the time said, you are not to fly until your wound heals and until we medically clear you. But Richthofen and by the way, he was the commander of the squadron, so he ignored that. And the high command issued an order saying, you will not fly, but they added, unless absolutely necessary. It was up to Richthofen to interpret that. And obviously he interpreted that as that most times it was absolutely necessary.
Most times it was absolutely necessary. He was German aircraft were at that time in the war were being newly challenged by, well, not only inexperienced Canadian and American flyers, but by British flyers and French flyers with much better aircraft at that stage of the war.
This is true. And by the way, if you want a study of evolution, mechanical evolution, just look at the difference between the aircraft in 1914 and 1918. I mean, they were making great progress by leaps and bounds.
Impossible to think that what the aircraft we saw in 1918, well, it was just at that point, 14 years after the Wright brothers' flight.
Indeed. It's absolutely remarkable. You know, the aircraft of 1914, they were just basically kites, you know, with underpowered kites. And by 1918, they were fairly, for the day, fast, efficient fighters. You know?
Mm-hmm. You're a neuropsychologist with the VA. How did you get interested in diagnosing the injuries of long-dead airmen?
Well, in the first place, I'm a former Air Force neuropsychologist. So aviation is an interest to me. Pilots are interesting to me. And what I do now at the VA, I work for a division called Compensation and Pension. So people come here with a claim. Often with post-traumatic stress disorder, sometimes a brain injury or some other mental disorder, and I examine them. And what I found, it's always a good idea to start digging through the files. It's fascinating, it's interesting, and you can learn a lot about a person by looking at their history. By the way, I was a history major before I ever became a psychologist, so this all sort of fits in. I found myself sometimes reading battle surgeon reports from 1943 or something of that nature. Fascinating stuff to me, and I feel quite honored. Sometimes I'm digging through and find a little yellow piece of paper, a note from a nurse back, maybe on the battlefield or at a seeing this person's history. I remember one time a veteran who'd been a prisoner of war in Germany, he said to me, you know what I did to keep myself sane? I said, what? He said, I made up menus. Menus, I said, yes. He said, would you like to see them? Yes. So we went out to his car, and he came back, and he had this little tablet. And every day that he was in captivity, he would make a new menu because they were, you know, their rations were terrible in camp. But he kept dreaming about what he was going to have. So one day he would have roast beef, mashed potatoes, and so forth. And it was quite touching. You know?
But obviously, as somebody who worked with pilots in the Air Force, you're well aware that if pilots are given an excuse, any excuse to be available to fly, most of them will go ahead and do it.
I don't know that that's true. I know that they certainly jealously guard their flight status. And I have known of cases where, yes, they've tried to conceal something. But I think most of the pilots that I know are also conscientious, and they also had enough common sense to know that they didn't want to put themselves or other people at risk, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of a delicate balance there, you know. I've got a cold. Do I tell the flight surgeon?
Thomas Hyatt, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thomas Hyatt is a neuropsychologist with the Veterans Administration, and he joined us from the VA's Medical Center in Cincinnati, Ohio.